Hello and welcome to the last episode of The Lit Pickers. We're recording this on star date March 29th, 2020. If we sound slightly underwater or in outer space, it's because we're both recording this on our phones in the comfort of our homes, which are a short walk from each other, but for now seem as far away as distant planets in a solar system. It's day 4 of the All India lockdown, and you're listening to me, Supriya Nair, and with me is Deepanjana Pal.
Or it's entirely possible that I'm Supriya Nair and you were just now listening to Deepanjana Pal, because if there's one thing that all of you who have been listening to us for the past few weeks have told us, then it is apparently that the two of us sound like each other, which honestly, I have never, ever considered a possibility. But here we are. Okay. Anyway,
Deepanjana, what are we going to do for this last episode of ours?
So it's been an incredibly enjoyable ride to do this podcast, not only because I have a fabulous co-host and we have amazing producers, but because of all the great support that we've got from all of you. And it's been a really weird time to be doing this podcast because, you know, the world seems to be going to hell. 2020 is a year with a vengeance, clearly. And I guess in some ways, the podcast has been a little bit of a refuge for us, definitely. But it seems like it has been a refuge for those of you who had been listening. So we thought what might be nice is for our last episode, we thought we'd take some questions from you and hear from you and then tell you what we have to say to your questions. So that's what we're going to be doing. Okay, so our first question is from an odd yellow on Instagram. What are the books you guys turn to when you're looking for comfort? And who are your favorite characters of all time?
What are the books I turn to when I'm looking for comfort? You know, I remember when I was a child, it used to be Johanna Spyri's Heidi. I remember that Heidi was always a big consolation to me because, you know, there was kind of a reliable moment in the middle. And if you've read Heidi, you know what it is when you just, you know, when you can't help but cry. And I think I liked that. I liked knowing that there was a book that I loved and that there was a part of it right in the middle that would make me weep gobbets of tears and that everything would be okay nonetheless. What else? I think as I grew older, I used to read the Lord of the Rings every year. Deepanjana, you and I have discussed our strange relationship with that book on a previous episode, so I won't linger too long on its effects. Needless to say, everyone who's been circulating that notorious quote from the movies about wishing that this had not happened in our time will get a sense of why Tolkien is specially comforting if that's what you're in the mood for. But otherwise, I don't know. I don't really read for comfort anymore, so it's been a while since I've gone back to my favorite books. I guess if someone made me like turned one book on my shelf right now, it would be, you know, the poetry of John Donne. What about you?
Oh, interesting. John Donne. I think for me, comfort and reading, it really depends on what my relationship with books is at that point. Like right now, I'm genuinely not able to focus on reading anything beyond a few paragraphs because I think my mind just wanders off to very real stuff around me. But I think reliably comforting over the years since puberty has been Mills and Boons for me. Mills and Boons and Tolkien, like you. So there you have it, a strange combination of oddness. But I think centrally in both of them is a similar promise that tropes can be used to tell good stories, that things will fall apart, but they can be rejoined again.
Yeah, so Anod Yellow's other question was, who are your favorite characters of all time? And I find all time a very difficult category from which to pick any one or two things. You know, I mean, if I had to pick something for now, I'd say, I think Sartaj Singh in Sacred Games is one of the characters I've liked the most while I was reading his novel. And Sacred Games is a novel that I'm very fond of. I haven't been able to watch the series, partly because it just doesn't scan the Sartaj Singh of the novel and, you know, Saif Ali Khan's kind of dead-eyed, wooden, you know, do-gooder type in the show. Sartaj also has a girlfriend in the novel called Mary, who I think, as far as I know, doesn't really make an appearance in the show. And I think both of them are really good characters. They're really compelling as... I mean, they're really wonderful creations in that they are good people who are also interesting, which I think a lot of writers find difficult to produce. Dipanjana, who are your favorite characters of all time?
Yeah, I have trouble with all time as well. But I have to say one character that has actually stayed with me since childhood till very far from childhood, which is where I'm at now, or close to second childhood, as it were, would be Modesty Blaze, the cartoon character. Modesty Blaze used to come as a comic strip in newspapers, in certain newspapers. I think she still does in some others. It's not like the stories were particularly good. The stories were pretty bad, actually. But as a character, I just loved this literally ass-kicking detective who is never quite on the right side of the law, but not entirely criminal either. There was something particularly shady about her, but she was very dynamic and she's very ballsy. Yeah, I really loved her. In recent times, I think a character who has actually, a literary character who stayed with me much longer than I had expected her to, is Essen from the Broken Earth series that N.K. Jemisin wrote. It's an incredible series of books set in a fantastical realm, a world in crisis and people just trying to survive, which, I mean, I can tell while I'm describing it why this might be staying with me at this point. But Jemisin is an amazing storyteller, but she also creates this incredibly potent character in Essen, because Essen makes mistakes and she learns from them, which I think is a quality that we really don't see enough of in literature. Like, people are either good or bad. They're always on an ascending arc, 9 times out of 10. But Essen is someone who truly grows, stumbles and grows.
That sounds really compelling. And I hope I'll have the time to read N.K. Jemisin's books, because you've just sold her to me so well right now. I hope we all have the time to read a lot more books in the future.
Amen. Amen. Okay. Next question from at Monofuzz. You mentioned Suniti Namjoshi in an episode. Who are some other Indian writers that you feel deserve more attention?
I think it's fair to say, and this is a widely acknowledged problem among Indian reviewers and publishers, that outside of English lies the vast landscape of Indian literary talent that remains largely unknown outside its native languages. There is a whole corpus of, you know, transformatively brilliant modern Indian literature that we don't have access to if we only read in English. So I think the answer to this is that, yes, there are so many whose names one such as I am inadequate to take and to describe. But in English, I don't know about neglect, because it feels like they're sort of talked about more than they're read. But I really, and I think maybe that's why I'm going to make a case for more people just reading, you know, sort of the great Indian poets in English. I know everyone is forced to like read Arun Kolhatkar in school or college or whatever, but, you know, he was one of a number of great contemporaries. And I think people will genuinely enjoy, should they read Dilip Chitre, both his own work and his translations of Marathi poetry, including that of Namdev Dhasal, the iconic Bombay poet in Marathi. Adil Jasawala, Chief Patel. Oh, also a book that actually very few people have read and is an absolute masterpiece is Magad by Srikant Verma, which got an English translation a few years ago by the great Rahul Soni, who is now an editor at HarperCollins India. It's perhaps the most extraordinary work of poetry that I've read in India, I mean, to have come out of India in years, and I love it. And if I can make one more, I feel like I've now sort of wittered on. One more suggestion. A lot of people have been introduced to Tamil Sangam poetry by A.K. Ramanujan's The Interior Landscape, which I'm very fond of and which I think is genuinely deserves all the praise it gets. But the translator M.L. Tangappa, whose Sangam work has been published in a Penguin Black classic as Love Stands Alone, is really, really special. And I think he deserves to be known and read also. Dipanjana, who are some of the Indians that you feel deserve more attention?
Give me a moment while I'm ordering Magad on Amazon, since I can't go to my favorite bookstore and make them get it. I would like to add Eunice D'Souza, who I don't think gets read enough. She's quite fantastic. Off the top of my head, there was also Arvind Krishna Mehrotra's translation of Prakrit poetry, love poetry particularly. There was a book called The Absent Traveler, I think. And it's a stunning volume. Would highly recommend it. I think if you're looking to discover new Indian writing, you would do well to look up publishers who are trying to do slightly experimental things, like Zuban, like Yoda Press, Fingerprint Publishing even. If you look at what these guys are bringing out, you are likely to find different names and people not at, from the similar cliques that mainstream publishing tends to publish. That said, last year we actually had a pretty strong set of new authors coming in, and you know, books like The Body Myth, The Far Field, Black Dwarves of the Good Little Bay, these were all first-time novels that were well worth reading, and these were names that we had not heard of before. So in its own way, maybe we are trying to rectify this in some way or the other.
Shout out also, you know, after Dipanjana's fantastic list of publishers, to the very new Panther's Paw publication, which operates out of Maharashtra, which is dedicated to publishing new and classic Dalit voices and their exciting, engaging political and literary work.
Moving on to the next question. This is from Kauri to Linus. Is there anything about reading and or literature that you find mysterious? That is a very mysterious question in itself. Kauri does explain that, you know, he's interested in the kind of storytelling devices that authors seem to use. Sometimes they're tropish, but they tend to know how they're going to manipulate practically a reader. So he writes, I honestly can't fathom why I'm so susceptible to these tricks. Another more profound one is the mystery of why poetry can affect parts of my brain no other art can reach. Mystery, if ever there was one. So anything you find mysterious about reading or literature, Supriya?
Would you like to take this first?
I think reading in general is mysterious, but in itself, I think it says more about us as a species that we find it odd that we're curious about other people's stories. Surely that should be basic. Curiosity is a very essential human, intrinsic rather, human trait. And, you know, reading sort of caters to that. And it is mysterious because we don't know how it's going to affect a reader. We don't know whether it's going to affect a group. We don't know when it'll be popular, when it will not be popular. Things that seem popular today will be completely forgotten 2 years down the line. Things that didn't work at all will seem to be resonant 200 years later. I mean, yes, it's mysterious, and that's what's amazing about it.
Well said. Kauri, thank you for the question. And since you mentioned that there were always tropes that managed to trick you into wondering, how did they do that? One of the things that I have a hard time figuring out is how people write well about sex, or more specifically, how people write good sex scenes. You know, I mean, it's obvious how visual pornography works, right? But I think to be able to write sex compellingly, see, I mean, that seems like really heavy lifting to me. And it amazes me that in romance novel after romance novel, more than you can count, women have, you know, kind of practically made an art form of writing sort of love scenes that both manage to like kind of advance the plot, that maybe tell you something more about the characters who are having sex. And it's stuff that, you know, makes your skin prickle. As a writer, I'm not sure that I'm ever going to be able to achieve that kind of balance perfectly. But as a reader, I'm quite delighted that there are other people who can.
sex scenes, I agree, they're really complex things to write, because as anyone who has even dreamt of having sex will tell you, that everything about sex conveys personality. So that's why you include it in a book, in whatever the genre might be, whether it's a romance or literary fiction or thriller or whatever the hell else. But I think one of the really amazing things about writing a good sex scene is finding words for body parts, because my God, our body parts do not sound sexy, particularly men, can I just say? I mean, not that words like, I don't know, pubis and labia are particularly hot, but neither is testicle and penis, really. Like, and the colloquial versions are even worse. So I know. I mean, props and praise to everyone who's able to write a sex scene without making the reader cringe. And many, many more props to the ones who can actually arouse physically and imaginatively the reader, because that's just amazing.
And no props to authors who think that they can write sex well, but who end up doing it, you know, as the meme says, she chested boobily.
Got it. Oh no, hysterical fit is happening now. Okay, yes, go on.
You know, as the meme says, she chested boobily down the stairs.
Okay. Oh, Guardian has a bad sex award, effectively, that it carries out every year, and you should look that up. It's just so much fun. Next question, and this is all the way from England. Nee has written to us saying, my questions are, why is the podcast coming to an end, and what book ending would you change for the better? The world is coming to an end, Nee. What's with the podcast? I mean, minor detail dropped in the ocean and all that. Look, the podcast is coming to an end because Supriya and I didn't think that this was going to go on forever. We've had great fun. But is there something that you would like to add to this?
No, I'm also wondering, the whole world is coming to end and you are worried about podcast. So how? Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. If we decide to do a new season, it'll be because of listeners like you. So we are very grateful. But I think our time is up now, just as the time of this whole age is up. So what book ending would you change for the better, Dipanjana?
My Lord, so many. I'm going to pick a book that I genuinely loved reading, and it has deservedly won a lot of awards from India. It's called The Far Field by Madhuri Vijay. It is an excellent book. It's a first novel, which is just remarkable in and of itself. It's a very nuanced look at what the mainlander perspective is when looking at Kashmir. Everything fantastic about this book, except for the end. The end had me tearing my hair out. And if you haven't read the book, then I'm afraid this is going to be a spoiler. So just, you know, don't listen for the next 10 seconds. Why does she sleep with the brigadier? Why? Why? Why must that happen? Okay, I'm done with my rant. The reason I didn't like it is because the rest of the novel is so well pitched. It's so alert to all the possibilities and respectful towards different perspectives that I just didn't expect this sudden sort of emotional tantrum at the end. So yeah, I found that horrible. What about you?
As soon as I read Nee's question, I knew what book I was going to talk about, because I think about this at least once a week. It's A Suitable Boy. If I could have Lata marry anyone but the person she actually ends up marrying, and let's be clear here, this is very much in keeping with the novel, right? Which is kind of resonantly, it grows as India itself has grown, is growing was going to grow at the time that it was written. So I understand where it's coming from. I understand where the choice that Lata makes comes from. You know, it's both kind of true to her life and it's true to the life of India. But I don't like it. I don't like it, Lata. I don't like it, Mr. Seth. If the book wasn't so heavy, I would have thrown it across the room when I came to that bit. And a better world is possible. A better love is possible. And I have lived my life believing that, which is why I am where I am right now. Okay, next question.
Amit Gurbaksani, a.k.a. The Groove Box, friend, journalist, and asker of questions. What's the maximum number of books you should be reading simultaneously? I like how Amit thinks that we are the arbiters of this. But anyway, what is the maximum number of books you should be reading simultaneously? And can we consume books the same way we consume episodic TV series? That's actually quite interesting to me. So Priya, do you read like you watch things?
I don't, wait one second. First of all, I don't understand this. What is the maximum number of books you should be reading question? I mean, it depends on whether you want to finish them or not. If that's not a concern, then you can read how many other books you want, yeah? But episodic TV series, I mean, okay, but it is a good question. Thank you very much, Amit. Yeah, I would actually really love it if I could like sit down and if I had the sort of book that I sat down and read for, you know, half an hour every day at 8 p.m. I mean, there's nothing to stop you from doing that sort of thing, right? But that's actually a lovely idea. So I don't know, I guess we should try it. I guess that's what bedtime reading is for a lot of people, right? It's like, okay, now it's 11, the house is quiet. Now I get a half an hour to read like the next 40 pages of this novel. I think that represents the height of luxury to me as a reader. I think that's lovely.
It's a world I want to live, truly, where you do get, you know, that sort of allocated time. But I think it's also, I'm not sure, but I feel Amit might also be asking about the binge watching thing that has become a trend with Netflix and streaming platforms like Netflix. I personally do binge. I binge on books much like I binge on TV shows or works by a director, an actor, but I think that's because I'm a slightly obsessive personality. That might be the reason why. I don't think it's necessarily the way to go. But yeah, I mean, personally, I read one book at a time. I'm very bad at doing this multiple books thing. So maximum number of books that I'm reading at a time is one. And can I consume books the same way I consume TV series? Yes, it seems I can.
Yeah, I can maybe read more than one if it's for work, because it's just a form of cramming then. You know, you just want to like kind of inhale the information. But otherwise, one at a time suits me just fine. I have no counter. I have no ticking counter. I have no like, no reading goal, nothing. If I can read 12 books a year, I'm fine with it. If I can read 4 books a year, I'm fine with that also, as long as I enjoy all 4. And that is the problem, isn't it?
Okay. I'm going to go now to Soumya Ancheri's question. Do you keep a record of passages and quotes that you love? If yes, how? So Priya?
No, I don't. I read things, I love them, I forget them, and then I scramble to find them again. What about you?
Do you write on your margins?
Yes, I do. I write on the end papers, so I keep notes quite a lot, but that's usually for work.
So I've always dreamt that I'll be able to, you know, just flip to the bit that I remembered and I will read a bit and I'll be like, oh, I will never forget these lines ever. That has so far not happened. I've tried different things. Like I try noting things down. I try highlighting them in the book sometimes, whether it's a Kindle or it's an physical copy of a book. If it's a physical copy, then I will use highlighters, pens. I don't think it actually helps. I don't think there is any record actually kept. Ultimately, I remember a book not in terms of those specific fragments, but more in terms of the way bits of it made me feel. So I will remember a character, or I'll remember that there were certain turns of phrase that at that point of time struck me as exquisitely beautiful, perhaps, or absolutely pedantic, perhaps. But damned if I can ever find them. Like I've tried putting them up online. I've tried many things. It has not worked. I'm just a crap documentarian. But a lot of people seem to use Instagram for this, and it works for them. You know, screenshot either that bit of the book or take a photograph of that page and have a separate Instagram account that's just, you know, essentially keeping a record of passages and quotes that you love. And nothing wrong with that. It's great.
Oh, I should try that. Thank you.
And moving swiftly on, we have a question from another author and writer and friend of mine, Bijal Vatrajani. How do you get writing done in a world that feels increasingly like dystopian fiction? Supriya, I will obviously ask you to answer this, but before that, I'm going to answer this myself. I don't know. How do you, Bijal? You're the one who wrote a book about climate change and pretty much the end of the world, which is saved by a bunch of amazing kids. A Cloud Called Bhura has won prizes and is generally brilliant. So, I mean, why are you asking me these questions? Anyway, so that's one. How do you get writing done in a world that feels increasingly like dystopian fiction? And how do you focus on deep reading when the anxiety to touch base with what's happening in the world is overwhelming? Supriya?
I don't know. I am finding it really difficult to write. Aren't you?
I've stopped putting writer in my bio.
Yeah, I guess you have to write about the times, and it's perhaps not very fair to ask either Dipanjana or I this question, because we both write for newspapers that, you know, we're on schedule, and when you're on schedule, you churn things out. But yeah, you write about the times, and I think maybe that's the only thing I feel capable of doing right now. You know, you write about the day you're in, the week you're in, the month you're in. Thanks for a great question, Bijal. I hope our listeners will have other ideas about how to practice this art in a time when it feels difficult. I think what consoles me, and this is true of both writing and of deep reading, which Bijal also asks about, is that, like, a lot of people have talked of these times as apocalyptic, but the truth is that we're at the beginning of something, right? And we're at the beginning of the rest of our lives. We are facing something that is going to go on for a long time. This was the case in India 3 months earlier, and it continues to be the case now. So I think reading and writing will come back in some form over time to those of us who are readers and writers. And in the meanwhile, the only thing we can do is practice discipline and have patience. What about you, Dipanjana? How are you?
Perhaps something that we should also keep in mind is why we're writing. As Supriya mentioned, for some of us, it's a job. So you have to write a certain amount and you have to respond to immediate things happening around you. But that's a separate professional, vocational problem, if you will. But why do you write otherwise? Like, what are you trying to do? And there is no right answer to this. The reasoning behind and the motivation behind your writing, I think, has a lot to do with this. There are people who create to just create a bit of beauty, to not respond to the world around them, perhaps to give themselves and the reader a sense of outlet away from it. I don't know what the reasonings are, but depending on why you write, you will, I think, find your words coming through when they need to. The only thing that you have to make sure, I think, you're doing while you wait for that moment is that you don't lose the habit of writing, because ultimately writing is labor. It's rigorous. It demands application. It demands concentration. It demands a certain amount of physical focus. And if you're out of the habit of writing, then dystopia, utopia, cacatopia, whatever it is that you're setting yourself in and your story in, it's not going to come out. So I think the only thing that I can say is that eventually the writing will get done. I mean, that's the hope that I think all of us writers live in, that eventually the writing will get done. And we're just going to have to be ready for that moment when it arrives. Any suggestions for a book series to read during this lockdown, preferably with three or more in the series, and something that is engrossing enough for me to forget about the pandemic even momentarily? Supriya, any suggestions?
This one is yours. The series is, I must confess, I too am waiting with bated breath to hear what you will say.
So I actually did a list of pandemic reading for my newsletter, which I'm still fascinated by the idea that anyone wants to read about a pandemic while in a pandemic. But that aside, I think the distraction point is really important. I would hugely recommend the Broken Earth series that I mentioned earlier by N.K. Jemisin. Earthsea Books, it's a cycle, it's not just a trilogy, by Ursula Le Guin. They're amazing, and there are a lot of books. Discworld, so much fun. If there was ever a time to pick up a series in which every book stands beautifully as a standalone, this is it. So, you know, Terry Pratchett, awesome. Also, I don't know. I mean, I feel like ultimately, for me, the best distraction is a series that creates a beautiful world, right? A world that is credibly beautiful, so that it has just the right balance of melancholia and hope. And for that, just you can't talk Tolkien.
Tolkien forever.
Yeah.
Well, how unpredictable we are. Right. When the word series came up, I thought of the last serial fiction that I really enjoyed. And it's by the cult detective writer, S.J. Rosan, who has a detective duo, Lydia Chin and Bill Smith, who are an unlikely pair who go around solving crimes in New York. I love it. She has a great handle on people. Lydia and Bill are both fantastic characters. The crimes themselves are, you know, they're engaging and so are the solutions, but they're also like sort of great love letters to cities, to neighborhoods, to communities. And I feel like we might be in the mood for that as we go from hour to hour without seeing, you know, just the strangers and the ebb and flow of life that we're used to in our cities and towns. I also catch flack for saying this, but I also think this is actually a really good time to read or sing from religious texts if you're not averse to them. You know, I mean, I'm not a believer, but I'm not averse to the textual aspects of religion either. And I think now more than ever, or perhaps for the first time in the lives of many of us, we are more linked than we have ever been to people who didn't live like us, to people who didn't live on the internet, who didn't live in metropolitan cities as they have grown to be in the 21st century, who didn't live, you know, in times of plenty, with great life expectancy, with medical care more accessible than ever before, with less violence in the world than ever before, with more full bellies than ever before. Suddenly, it feels like the veil between this world of ours and the past has been drawn back. So I'm interested in what it feels like now, you know, to sing a hymn or to read a verse about compassion and faith and togetherness in your holy book, whatever that may be, and figure out how it feels. So, you know, maybe just my two bits.
Good stuff. Next question. Is there a book you cherished as a child or teenager but would not revisit or recommend as an adult? Why? For our question now, it's Sidney Sheldon that they were specifically thinking about. I love this question. Supriya?
Now I can see why this person is anonymous, and I can't believe I'm about to admit it, but I read a lot of Jeffrey Archer when I was growing up. And I'm afraid all the flaws in my character come from there. So I definitely do not recommend. What about you?
Eric Van or Von Lustbader. I can't remember if it was Von or Van, but anyway, he wrote a series of books which were in Orchid Lending Library of Goriahat at the time. We're talking early 90s. And it was recommended to me by Orchid Lending Library proprietor, whose name I have now forgotten. They are the worst books. But because I trusted a proprietor, when I read them, I thought, oh, what an exotic, fabulous view of Japan. It was a white guy writing about Japanese ninjas, and there was like bizarre sex and weird things in there. It was just terrible. I consumed them, devoured them, truly. Miko, Ninja, like these were the names of the books that I still remember. Terrible, please don't go back to them. Something that did strike me while I was reading that question was that it's curious what you remember of a book when you're going back to it. So one of my favorite books is Margaret Atwood's Cat's Eye. And for anyone who's read Cat's Eye, you will know that the book is not just about these girls bullying a new student who comes to the school called Elaine. The book goes far beyond those childhood years. But, and I know it, I love that book. I've read it like, I don't know how many times. And Elaine is a fantastic character. Things that happen later in her life, also very exciting, etc. But Cat's Eye to me is all about Elaine and Cordelia, the bully. It's just bizarre what stays in your head of a book. So maybe if it isn't Sidney Sheldon, Eric von Lusbader, or Jeffrey Archer, maybe you want to go back to that book and take a read again. You might be surprised with what you find.
What a lovely thought. Okay. What, Dipanjana, what's our next question?
I love this question. So big thanks to the person who sent this in. How does one delve into a completely new genre? And do you look at bestseller lists, start with what is considered classic in the genre, or attempt the new stuff only? Do you have a process for this? Do you have a process for approaching a new genre, Supriya?
No, I have none. I only go by recommendations from friends. And sometimes when I read like a really well-written review, but that's obviously more relevant to newer stuff than it is for the classics. So what about you?
Yeah, recommendations are big for me, but I think when I read the question, I immediately thought about fantasy as a genre, which I didn't really know that much about beyond Tolkien, as we may have established over the course of the last few weeks. But I picked up a book quite randomly at an airport bookstore back when there were bookstores in airports and one could, you know, go to the airport and do things like travel. So basically in another century. So essentially I just chanced upon a book and it was incredible, the world that it had created. And I started looking up that author, started to read another book that they had written and just did not like it at all. So abandoned that one and instead went to the acknowledgements and saw what other books, you know, what other authors they've thanked and picked one of them. And, I've actually found that authors recommending, like blurbs are a terrible way of deciding whether a book is good or not, but authors who recommend other authors, I have great respect for. So that generally works out quite nicely for me. But by and large, I'm very lucky to have extremely well-read friends who read across a very wide variety of fields. So I tend to rely on them.
Amazing. And for our last question, we have, who is your favorite romance author? And if you had to, what is the one book of theirs you would recommend? I haven't read romance in so long that this is really going to take me some time. Dipanjana, is there anyone who comes to mind as a favorite?
So while Supriya is thinking about her recommendations for romance writers, I am obviously in my favorite genre right now. So yes, I have many, many recommendations, but I'm going to limit myself to three. One is Maisie Yates, who is an American author. She's written Harlequin / Mills and Boone novels, but also has like larger novels of her own. That are not under the Mills and Boone banner. Great fun, sexy, very sort of, you know, stereotypical in many ways, but good fun. The other contemporary author that I would recommend is Avril Tremaine, who is Australian, and I have only read her Mills and Boone novels. I don't know if she's written anything else, but I like her writing because it's also very funny, and she has unusual women leads, you know, not your stereotypical female protagonist. So I quite enjoy her stuff as well. All-time favorite, though, Georgette Heyer. Absolutely love her. Love the worlds that she writes about. They're very humorous. They're very sweet. And I have a lot of fondness also for the way she went about it. Like, she was extremely reclusive, never gave an interview. As far as she was concerned, she put her books out there. So, you know, read them if you want, don't read them if you don't. And then just keep going. Love that. So those are my three.
Okay, well, I will pick three as well then. Dipanjana, you perhaps left out Anuja Chauhan, because her books don't fall into a kind of category romance. And they're about a bunch of other things. And I know that reactions to her work can vary widely from book to book. But I think she's a great writer of love stories. And her first three novels, I think, still stand out, not just in commercial Indian fiction, but just in Indian writing in general, because they're so much fun. And they're so warm and warm-hearted. The last romance novel I read a couple of years ago was called A Princess in Theory. It created a bit of a stir because it was one of the rare commercial romances to make its way to the New York Times' best of list in that year. And Alyssa Cole, the author, is African-American, and A Princess in Theory, which is a very fun book about, you know, about a hardworking young African-American woman down on her luck who happens to fall in love with the prince of a fictional African country, you know, and like have exciting adventures following. I thought it was really cool. And the last series that I read sort of many years ago that I really liked was by Loretta Chase, who has this, I think, a quartet or a quintet of novels. Someone is going to have to do the hard work of Googling these and figuring them out. The Regency romances about a series of brothers and, you know, the brides that they find. And I thought they were all a great deal of fun. So, yeah, that's what I have for you.
I'm so glad you mentioned Anuja Chauhan. She had totally slipped my mind because, like you said, I think in my head, she's just a popular fiction author. But you're right. She writes love stories so well. And yeah, Dhillon Singh Shekhawat is mine. I'm just saying. Okay.
And thank you for all of your recommendations, which I'm going to go look up.
And thank you to all of you who have been listening to us for all of this episode and also for the past few weeks. We were truly, truly surprised and pleasantly overwhelmed by how kind you have all been in your responses. And it's been great fun bringing this to you. We're very glad that we have been able to give you a moment of respite from the craziness of the world at large. A lot of you wrote to us saying that, you know, these episodes have been something of a little bit of a retreat from reality, and we're very glad that we were able to provide you that. Before we leave, and at the end of this season, especially as it comes in the times that it does, I thought it would be nice to end, or rather for us to say goodbye, on a slightly poetic note. This is from a poem by Mary Oliver, and this is how it goes. I tell you this to break your heart, by which I mean only that it break open and never close again to the rest of the world. So in these heartbroken times, here's hoping that we all recover and that our hearts are never closed again.
Thank you so much. Thank you to our listeners. And we'll see you on the other side. For now, goodbye.
This is a Made in India production. The editorial producers are Mae Thomas and Sean Phantom. Shanya Subramanian is our producer, and the assistant producer is Janam Devan. These episodes are edited by Vijay Doifure and recorded by Adriel George, as well as the Island City Studio. Our theme music is Here's to You by the Easy Wanderlings.